LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. On today's show, now why is neon making a comeback?
Every business in Los Angeles had to have a neon sign. If not one, they had to have five neon signs. We look around and we think we have a lot of neon now. We had a heck of a lot more in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. It's a neon city.
Hear from Eric Linksweiler later in the show. And the Office of Historic Resources has just unveiled its list of Jewish cultural landmarks. Avishai Artsy looks at one community's imprint on our cityscape. Before we get to that, though...
In your Frigidaire cold pantry, there's a place for all your food. Fresh and frozen, canned, bottled and wrapped, new bought and leftover. They're all right there, and they're all at your fingertips.
That was a 1956 ad for a Frigidaire refrigerator icebox. Now, thanks to its love affair with fridges, Americans have the biggest refrigerators in the world. Not only that, the US outstrips the rest of the world in the use of air conditioning. Now, other countries are catching up as they get wealthier. In India and China, for example, air conditioning sales are reportedly growing 20% a year. And all of this presents a challenge to Mother Earth. It turns out that HFCs, or hydrofluorocarbons, the greenhouse gases commonly used in refrigeration and air conditioning, seriously warm the planet. Now, they replaced older CFCs that damage the ozone, but it turns out the HFCs warm the planet at levels thousands of times more than does carbon dioxide, the standard greenhouse gas. That's all according to the New York Times. But last week, negotiators for nearly 200 countries agreed on a deal to rein in levels of HFCs. So does this mean we need to rein in our addiction to keep things chill? Or is there a clean alternative to HFCs? Jonathan Rees is author of a book called Refrigeration Nation, A History of Ice, Appliances and Enterprise in America.
The problem with cutting back on HFCs at this point is so many of them are already out there and are being used. They're in closed systems, which means that your refrigerator doesn't give off these gases. But that's why your refrigerator has to be disposed of correctly. Because if it's not disposed of correctly, if it just ends up leaking all the refrigerant out, then that's a terrible disaster for global warming. The same thing with your air conditioner. It's using probably the same kinds of chemicals. So really, the agreement is more of a start for a gradual shift into other chemicals. And there are different kinds of CFCs that are much safer for the environment. And although I haven't seen the agreement up close, I think that's probably where we're going.
So you're saying that we're going to a different chemical rather than a suggestion to folks to cut back on their use of air conditioning or to downscale the size of their fridges?
It's always good if you can do something for the environment by downscaling the size of your fridge, but that's not a HFC problem. That's greenhouse gases emitted by the power generation that runs your fridge problem, as opposed to the gas inside the refrigerator.
I see. But you say there are gases that can replace these HFCs.
Not only that, there are new technologies on the way that don't even require chemicals at all. It is above my pay grade to describe them, but my understanding is that the next generation of refrigerators will run on a combination of water and magnets.
Wow. Now, you are the go-to guy on fridges. You've written that Americans have the biggest refrigerators in the world, 17.5 cubic feet of volume on average. Why so big?
I would say that the reason that American refrigerators are so big is because we have had refrigeration marketed to us literally since the early 19th century. Back in the days when the only refrigeration we could get was through cutting ice off of ponds and leaving it in ice boxes, the people who did that would give away ice, and then we would be hooked on ice in our drinks, and then people would start paying for it in the future. That was a tactic from that time. In the mid-20th century, the reason that refrigerators gradually grew is because the refrigerator manufacturers wanted to sell us new refrigerators when our old refrigerators worked perfectly fine. So it's not quite planned obsolescence because the old refrigerators could still function, but they said, you know, if you need a party at a moment's notice, you should have two or three extra cubic feet in your refrigerator. And that's why so many people would move their old refrigerators to the basement, put drinks in them, and buy a brand new, bigger refrigerator for their kitchens, and then have even more refrigerator capacity than just about anywhere else on the planet. And, of course, run two refrigerators at the same time. The cost of electricity is so low in America compared to other countries that it actually makes some economic sense to do that.
And then you add to that the American love of bulk buying.
Which I think could only happen if we had giant refrigerators. I haven't seen any work on, you know, exactly when bulk buying came around, but the large stores develop in the decades immediately after the refrigerator becomes omnipresent in American homes.
Because they can transport food in refrigerated lorries.
Yes, which is a different sort of refrigeration, but it's still related to people being able to put more refrigerated goods in their home.
But not only do Americans love to keep their food chill and have ice in their drinks, they also love to air condition their houses more than anyone else.
Yes.
Why this propensity for wanting everything to be cold?
That's interesting. Air conditioning is the same technology as refrigeration. They develop right around the same time. Air conditioning comes from the 19-teens, and the first really effective household refrigerators come from the same time. It's just a natural side effect of being able to do that economically is, you know, if you can keep your food fresh, why not keep yourself fresh, too? And, you know, whole areas of the country would be uninhabitable, both because of the heat and the inability to get fresh vegetables if it weren't for refrigeration. Of both kinds. So it really is a very important technology.
But then we have this kind of ironic development back to the deal reached around HFCs, is that more and more AC and refrigerators have been installed over the past century, contributing to climate change, which, as we understand it, causes more desertification, makes places hotter, which then requires more refrigeration. So this is kind of a cycle. Is it a cycle that can be interrupted?
I think it can through new technology all along the chain. There are ways to preserve food and keep the taste that'll be more energy efficient. They won't require as much energy to run that refrigeration technology. And as I said, if there's a new kind of refrigeration other than the 150-year-old technology that currently operates in your fridge right now, then I think it's possible to leave a much smaller carbon footprint.
Alternatively, is it possible to design, say, homes, offices that don't necessarily need air conditioning? Certainly, I'm aware of more buildings on, say, the west side of Los Angeles, typically where buildings would be cross-ventilated by cool breezes from the sea, and they're bringing in AC. Do they need that AC? Is it because it's getting hotter, or are they not planning in a way that permits the cross-ventilation of cool breezes?
Oh, it's absolutely possible. Not all countries in the world with a climate like Los Angeles have access to AC, and they will be able to function. And that cultural preference can change. In the same way that marketers marketed ice and then refrigerators, it is possible to convince people over time that air conditioning is less necessary, particularly as new technologies make it possible to keep cool in different ways.
Well, Jonathan Rees, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
Jonathan Rees is author of Refrigeration Nation, A History of Ice, Appliances and Enterprise in America. He's also author of another book on refrigeration called Refrigerator. Well, Jonathan, all I can say is stay cool.
Oh, appreciate it.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Now, most cities in LA County today are pretty strict about signage. That was not always the case, though. In fact, at one time, streets were cacophonous with vivid neon signs. Tom Zimmerman is author, and Eric Linksweiler is the editor and graphic designer of a new book called Spectacular Illumination. Neon Los Angeles, 1925 to 1965. We went to visit them at the Museum of Neon Art in Glendale. There you can find some classic works of LA neon art, including the sign from a much-loved institution.
This is the 1929 Brown Derby rooftop sign. It is the original iconic hat-shaped sign from the top of the Hollywood and Vine Brown Derby restaurant, home of the Cobb salad.
How did you acquire this? Where has it been all these years?
It came down and it went into a boneyard where it was going to be thrown away. It was going to be scrapped. A private collector bought the sign from the scrapyard, wound up selling it to Universal Studios. Universal Studios was opening up City Walk, and they thought that they could reopen the Brown Derby restaurant. However, it's still copywritten. They said, oops, no. And they wound up donating it to the Museum of Neon Art.
But for many of us who love the Brown Derby, the image is also of the hat, you know, not just the neon. Hear the stories about the neon. Tell us that story.
Well, the neon in Los Angeles is a big deal. Maybe Las Vegas or Times Square in New York may be more popular for neon, but Los Angeles was the city of the automobile, and every business in Los Angeles had to have a neon sign. If not one, they had to have five neon signs. And the photographs that we chose for the book tried to represent the fact that Los Angeles is a neon city. We look around and we think we have a lot of neon now. We had a heck of a lot more in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. It's a neon city. It became such a cacophony of light and display and vibrancy and shimmering lights that cities nationwide really overreacted and started shutting down neon. By the 1960s and 70s, there was a reaction against neon, and we started seeing quite a loss. Different cities, including Glendale, the home of the Museum of Neon Art, basically had a referendum to say no more neon, period, and get rid of all the old stuff, too.
You feel sad at the passing of that LA.
It absolutely true. I look back at the photographs in our book, Spectacular Illumination, and it just slays me. I wish I could reach into the photograph and save these neon signs that did not survive. Oh, I just pine for the past, to have a time machine.
But Tom, why does this story start in 1925?
Well, that's supposedly the first neon sign is invented in France, Georges Claude. Developed the way to make a neon sign, the bending of the glass and all that stuff. What we really did add to it were these endless commercial strips. That was a real development of LA because obviously of the car. And you didn't have stuff like that in New York because, you know, people were on subways. And you can see it in especially the older movies made right after the war, the film noir movies, as the gunsel is driving down the street with the poor guy about to get killed or something. They're always driving by 10,000 neon signs. And, you know, that's not stage set. That they're there and they're just driving down the street.
And it was colorful. It was streamlined, crisp, clear, very legible, just bent glass. Illuminated light bulb signs were like pointillism in light. Giant flapping eagle wings, pouring beers, beautiful. But you could do it a lot more cleanly with neon. Neon took over and actually canceled out the light bulb. That lasted until about the mid-1960s. Neon signs started to represent film noir, as Tom mentioned, down and out bars and Skid Row. And in the 1960s, what was on the rise but backlit plastic signs.
And in terms of illumination, we've moved into LED.
Yeah, nowadays it's LED. And a lot of people are saying, well, LED is the next best thing. I have an incredible bias towards neon and away from LED. Giant TV sets of LED light, that's great. Neon can't do that. But when it comes to signage, it's just a cold, dead light. Neon lasts longer. And the best example of that is at Clifton's Cafeteria in downtown Los Angeles. While the Clifford Clinton Cafeteria was being remodeled, the owner wound up finding a 1930s neon tube still burning behind an enclosed wall. That neon tube had been functioning since the 1930s, buried behind a wall, and it is everything that we at the Museum of Neon Art have been claiming, that neon can last indefinitely.
You listen to Eric Linksweiler. Now, as it turns out, neon is making a bit of a comeback. Thanks to the Lumens Project, created by the LA Department of Cultural Affairs under the leadership of Al Nodal, more than 130 of LA's vintage neon signs have been restored. And more neon is coming to downtown LA from the restored Clifton's Cafeteria and Jesus Saves above the theatre at the Ace Hotel to new signs at Grand Central Market, where current vendors must have a neon design approved by owner Adele Yellen. This new neon is associated with urban renewal, the opposite of the seediness it represented in the noirish depictions of LA that Tom Zimmerman loves, like, for example, the 1967 movie Point Blank.
It's a Lee Marvin film from the late 60s, and there's a scene in it where Marvin is driving down, it's actually in Culver City on Washington Boulevard, he's driving down on his way to try and get his money back, which is his big deal. And nobody wants to give it to him, so he keeps killing people. But he's driving down, and it's like he's being mocked by these endless neon signs while he's all, you know, concerned about, you know, getting his money back. So that's one, and that's a very late one, and it's all in color. There's one called T-Men, and it, you know, Treasury Men, and they keep going either San Francisco and then they're down in LA, and there's all these incredible signs all over the place.
Your museum also shows contemporary work in neon. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Museum of Neon Art is two halves of one giant illuminated coin. On one half, we have glowing neon signage, vintage Americana roadside car culture signage. But on the other side of that, I need to point out that we were founded by neon artists in 1981. So the Museum of Neon Art exists in order to give electric artists a home. We're focusing in January on single electrode artwork and plasma sculptures. Kind of crazy. Can't wrap your head around it, but you have to come and visit us to see what that's all about.
That was Eric Linksweiler and Tom Zimmerman. Their new book is Spectacular Illumination, Neon Los Angeles, 1925 to 1965. And you can see some of the signs they talked about in the current exhibition at the Museum of Neon Art in Glendale. It's called Hats Off to Hollywood. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, DNA's producer Avishai Artsy takes us on a tour of Jewish Los Angeles and explains how that community has shaped development in the region.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton, and this weekend DNA's producer Avishai Artsy will lead folks on a tour of the Jewish history of Boyle Heights. This is the culmination of a year of research he's been doing on the Jewish imprint on LA's built environment, and he's here to talk about it. The journey starts, he says, decades before the founding of Hollywood by Jewish immigrants.
So German and Polish Jews first began arriving in LA in the 1840s and 50s, and they immediately became part of the city's leadership. They were bankers and merchants, and they didn't feel social exclusion on account of their ethnicity, but they were a tight-knit group with a few leading families. One of those was the Newmarks. So Joseph Newmark became the lay rabbi of LA, and his son Harris founded the LA Public Library. He also became a landowner with vast holdings that stretched from what's now Montebello in East LA all the way to Santa Monica, as well as the Temple Block in downtown where LA City Hall now stands. There's a great story about Harris Newmark that Jewish historian Edmund Rodman told me.
He was walking down the street and he heard an auction happening. And not knowing what property he was bidding on, all he heard was a number. I think it was $7. And just not even knowing what he's bidding on, he says, I'll pay $7.50. He won. And he later finds out he purchased property, which at that time, you know, Wilshire Boulevard area wasn't anything. But it later becomes part of the area, the Wilshire District.
Besides Harris Newmark, there were also the developers of the San Fernando Valley, like Isaac Lankershim, who was born into a pious Jewish family. He later converted to become a Baptist. And lastly, any discussion of LA's Jewish pioneers needs to include Isaias Hellman. He was a prominent banker. He helped found USC and several of the railroads. He lent the money to Harrison Gray Otis to buy the Los Angeles Times and to Edward Doheny and Charles A. Canfield to drill for oil. Hellman also co-owned much of Boyle Heights.
Okay, so Boyle Heights, really important part of this entire story. Let's hear a little bit about Boyle Heights.
Okay, now we're looking at, say, about the 1920s to the 1960s. Because up until then, there was no real distinct Jewish neighborhood. Boyle Heights became what's been called sort of the Ellis Island of Los Angeles. A lot of immigrants from Europe, as well as from the East Coast and the Midwest, ended up in Boyle Heights. There were 10,000 Jewish households living there in the 1930s, which accounted for about a third of LA's Jewish population.
And they were living alongside people of many backgrounds. They were not the only people.
No, it was the most multicultural and diverse neighborhood in Los Angeles. I mean, you had large numbers of Mexican, Black, Japanese, Russian, Armenian, Italian, and Irish residents. Among the residents of Boyle Heights were these Yiddish-speaking Jews that brought with them union organizing and radical activism. A lot of them were socialists, communists, and anarchists, and they organized some of the first unions, including the Bread Bakers Union, the Garment Workers, and the Carpenters Unions. And they weren't just doing it by themselves. They worked alongside Mexican and Black and other activists in fighting Nazism and fascism and segregation.
And some of those left-wing tendencies that you're talking about in Boyle Heights also did find architecture expression in Los Angeles. One can name a few architects of Jewish descent who really made their mark in the early and mid-century modernist movement. We can think of Rudolf Schindler and Richard Neutra, emigres from Vienna, Austria. And then we also have Gregory Ayn and Rafael Soriano.
Adding to those names, a couple other emigres, Paul Laszlo and Victor Gruen, who's credited as the inventor of the shopping mall, and a lot of influential architects worked in his office. But back to Rafael Soriano, early in his career, Julius Shulman, the architectural photographer, recommended him to build the Soto, Michigan Jewish Community Center. They were friends for a long time. Shulman grew up in Boyle Heights and was on the board of the JCC. And on Shulman's insistence, Soriano put a dark room in the JCC, and a lot of the young Latino photographers that came out of Boyle Heights got their start in that dark room. Interesting little side story
yeah.
there.
And of course, there are some other notable architects who happen to be Jewish in Los Angeles.
Probably the most well-known is Frank Gehry.
Absolutely.
Born Frank Goldberg. Now, the end of the Jewish story in Boyle Heights is really around the late 1950s, early 1960s. The neighborhood's now about 95% Latino, and Brooklyn Ave was renamed Cesar Chavez Ave in 1994.
So why did the Jews leave Boyle Heights?
I mean, there are a few reasons. One is that the restrictive housing covenants began to lift, so Jews could move into what were formerly only white neighborhoods. There was the construction of the East LA Interchange. There's also the anti-communist scare of the 1950s, which severed many of the Jewish bonds within Boyle Heights, as many of the radical groups were shunned by the Jewish establishment. There's the redlining in which banks wouldn't give people loans to buy homes in places like Boyle Heights because they were considered too diverse and too subversive.
So Jewish people start moving west. We heard on a previous DNA about Wilshire Boulevard Temple. That was a significant marker in that story, but they move even further west.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, there was already the Jewish neighborhoods like Hollywood and the Fairfax District, but really the San Fernando Valley became sort of a central place for Jews to go to. There were several important Jewish developers that built homes in the San Fernando Valley, S. Mark Taper, Louis Boyar, Lawrence Weinberg, and perhaps most well-known, Eli Broad, who, along with Donald Kaufman, founded Kaufman and Broad in 1957 in Detroit, which became KB Homes, and they built thousands of tract homes in the valley.
So you just mentioned Eli Broad. He is now known for his contribution in developing some of LA's great cultural institutions and much of the redevelopment efforts on Grand Avenue. Back in the day, when Kaufman and Broad was building, they were actually contributing to the decentralization of Los Angeles. Now, Eli Broad is very keen on creating a cultural heart of LA. I did ask him about this, actually, back in 2004.
We were building homes for people that were more traditional families. They wanted a yard, they wanted maybe a little swimming pool, and they wanted additional bedrooms and so on. And yes, we were part of, as many were part of the sprawl that's been created here. That's what the public wanted. Now, people, more and more people are going to want to live in this central city.
It's great to hear from Eli Broad. I think he is one of the central figures in developing Los Angeles in the last 50 years.
Absolutely. And then, interestingly, as they move to the San Fernando Valley, so the 405 becomes a significant artery.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. If you look at that Sepulveda Pass, besides the Getty and a Catholic university there, you have Leo Beck Temple, you have American Jewish University, Milken Community High School, Stephen S. Wise Temple, and built in the 90s, the Skirball Cultural Center.
By the Israeli architect Moshe Safdi, let's just add.
I talked to him a few years ago when the Skirball did a retrospective of his work, and it's hard to imagine now because the Skirball is this kind of beautiful complex of gallery spaces and terraces and gardens, but 30 years ago is literally a garbage dump. If you wanted to get rid of your microwave or something, you would drive up the 405 and throw it into what's now Skirball. And Moshe Safdi really saw something else that could be there.
I thought it should be a kind of an oasis. This is a city of freeways, and I felt it should be a place where you come to which is calm and serene and green and a paradise garden, so that you've kind of escaped the hustle bustle of the city to be here.
So that was Moshe Safdi, and that brings me to the latest wave of developers and architects of Jewish descent making their mark on LA now. You can count the Persian Jews of Beverly Hills, who arrived around the time of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, and they built Tarangelis, and they replaced some of the original single-story bungalows with what have been called Persian palaces. And this is funny, it's been said the size of their Friday Shabbat dinners made them want to build bigger homes.
Oh, yes, yes, Persian palaces, known for their opulence. Anyway, in addition to the Persians, back to the Israelis, we do have now quite a few Israeli developers working in L.A.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of them, Isaac Shomov, started buying real estate in downtown Los Angeles in the early 90s. He's worked on the transformation of the historic Sears complex in Boyle Heights. That has been another lightning rod in that neighborhood because that's going to be a mix of affordable and upscale units.
And we are now seeing another phase in that story because of this tension surrounding gentrification.
Yeah, I think Isaac Shomov is one of the Israeli developers that is seeing a lot of promise in areas around downtown. So just as he and Yuval Bar-Zemer invested in the Arts District, I think Boyle Heights will become a very hot area for developers and investors. And you're seeing the residents of Boyle Heights really stand up against that and try to drive out the gentrifiers, which in this case is artists and art galleries that are kind of starting to creep in across the river.
So we've done this double quick tour through the Jewish built fabric of Los Angeles. To what extent was being Jewish a factor in the lives and works of all these individuals we've talked about?
I think it really depends on each person. I will say, for instance, some of the Jewish pioneers of Los Angeles were members of Congregation B'nai B'rith, which is now Wilshire Boulevard Temple. Some of the more recent developers and architects that we've talked about have been supporters of Jewish philanthropies and of Israeli causes. A lot of Jews came to Los Angeles because it was an open society without entrenched social hierarchies. Like Karen Wilson from UCLA says, they could be among the architects of social renovation rather than have to accept marginalization.
So Avishai, I think we've just skimmed the surface of a very rich history here. It's a history that some people are going to hear a piece of when you take them on a tour of Jewish history in Boyle Heights this weekend.
Yep. Besides that, the Office of Historic Resources for the City of Los Angeles has been putting out these historic context statements about various groups in Los Angeles and various industries, and they've just put out one about the Jewish history of Los Angeles and some of the associated landmarks, which is fascinating. And then Mapping Jewish LA, which is an ongoing project from UCLA, has an exhibit about Boyle Heights that's going to be up from November 6th to 9th in Royce Hall.
Well, Avishai Artsy, it's really very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francis. Can I stop talking about Jews now?
Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. I'm Francis Anderton, and that's it for today's show. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Stephanie Case. The segment about Jews and the development of Los Angeles was made possible with support from California Humanities. That's a partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.